On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Google speeds up TCP/IP, Comcast no longer wants to serve the public good, and Shotput is the robotic grocer for your future. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 255, recorded September 1st, 2017. Shotput.
Come with me if you want to shop.
Welcome to Twyatt This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasier, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise, but I cannot guide you by myself. I'm going to need a little help from my friends, starting, of course, with Mr. Brian Chi. He is the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii, where I am understood it's the temperature of the surface of the sun right now?
It's hot and humid and just kind of nasty.
Now, you've got a weird situation in that you are right next to your data center. Is this a time when you try to leave the doors open so that that data center cooling comes into your office?
Yeah, pretty much. Actually, right now it's so hot I'm hiding in the big data center.
Oh, the one downstairs. I remember that.
Actually, no. The biggest one we have where all our clusters are is in the basement of the next building over. That one is a chill water-based system.
Well, we had a walk-in freezer at our high school, which is no longer working because the kitchen staff had been taking their breaks in there because it's gotten so warm in San Francisco. But we're not here to talk about the heat, Chiebert. In fact, we've got a great show lineup for the Twyatt Riot. We're going to be talking a little bit about being a grocer on the go in just a bit. We've got Shotput coming on to tell you about the future of the delivery of food. But first, as we always do, we have to kick it off with the blips. Now, if you want Cisco features, you have to buy Cisco hardware. That's the way it's always been, but maybe not for much longer. Yesterday, Cisco announced that they're developing integrations between their application-centric infrastructure, or ACI, and Amazon Web Services, Microsoft Azure, and Google Cloud. In the overall Cisco strategy, these integrations are a crucial step in creating hybrid environments that allow a single set of policies and application management across on-premise and cloud deployments. Furthermore, in a blog post, Cisco execs mused about the possibility of third-party cloud management tools, like Microsoft's Azure Stack, to control ACI through its APIs, which would create a first-ever choose-your-own management suite feature within any hybrid deployment. There's plenty of work to be done before they have a releasable product, but for the 4,000-strong and growing ACI customer base, this could be the killer feature that rules all deployments.
Well, 456,000 people are told to visit the doctor for a critical pacemaker vulnerability patch? Huh? Really? It's probably the most crucial patch of the year. Ha ha ha. Abbott Laboratories reworked firmware for its St. Jude pacemakers has won the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approval to ship. The key to the statement is that the firmware upgrade should go smoothly nearly all the time. Gee, Mr. Jones, sorry about that awful pain in your chest, but just hold on while I try that upgrade again. Could you just imagine having 456,000 users of any piece of hardware being forced to visit the dealer to get a potentially life-threatening software upgrade instead of an over-the-air upgrade? On one hand, it's nice to be in a doctor's office in case of an oops, and I'd hate to have my pacemaker updated while I'm playing a game of tennis. Okay, so maybe a doctor's visit for an upgrade does sound like a good idea, but man, that's a heck of a lot of upgrades. Does this mean Abbott Laboratories is someday going to have a Patch Tuesday?
You get a Ryzen, and you get a Ryzen, and you get a Ryzen. Everybody gets a Ryzen. Yesterday, at a global launch event in New York City, AMD officially released its 8-core Ryzen Threadripper 1900X processor. It's a budget version of AMD's 16-core Threadripper 1950X. The 1900X has 8 cores clocked at 3.8 gigahertz with a 4 gigahertz turbo mode, is priced at $549, about half the cost of their 16-core version, is contained within a 2-die package, and sports 4 megabytes of L2 and 16 megabytes of L3 cache. The new chip fits into an STR4 socket-equipped motherboard and offers a massive complement of 60 PCIe lanes, 4 memory channels supporting ECC, NVMe RAID, and all the I.O. goodness that comes with their high-end 1800X part. But this isn't just a speed bump or a price drop. AMD used the event to target the enterprise with features like Trusted Platform Module 2.0, GuardMe, and SenseMe that provide hardware hooks for security and virtualized application tuning. Additionally, AMD announced partnerships with HP, Dell, and Lenovo to push Ryzen parts from the pipeline into the channel. In short, don't be surprised if AMD is in your next batch of servers or high-end workstation hardware.
Oh, man, this time the data breach is low-tech, but it still earned Aetna a class-action black eye. Aetna is accused of breaching the privacy rights of 12,000 customers in 23 states by snail-mailing them letters in which the words "filled prescriptions for HIV" could be read through the transparent window on the envelopes. Oops. One would have thought that someone might have thought this out a bit better, not publicly outed a huge number of HIV patients using the U.S. mail. And of course, Aetna is blaming the contractor that was responsible for mailing out the notices. Look for this one to drag out in the courts with Aetna trying to throw the mailing contractor under the bus. Well, at least Aetna didn't post patient records on a public internet forum, and supposedly our U.S. postal workers are discreet. But really? A windowed envelope that displays confidential information because someone was trying to recycle some envelopes they bought too many of in the first place?
Now, TCP was first developed in the 1970s as a way to transmit packetized data across the internet. It's been patched and tweaked over the years, and its robustness is the reason why almost 50 years later, it still accounts for more than 90% of all IP traffic, which is why the engineers at Google have been working to squeeze a bit more performance out of TCP. And they've succeeded. By creating a new algorithm that attempts to avoid clogged routes, Google's bottleneck bandwidth and round-trip propagation time, or BBR, can speed up TCP/IP by an astounding 14%. This isn't the first attempt to speed TCP/IP, but while past efforts have built mechanisms to avoid congested routes, switching when packet loss becomes unacceptable, Google's attempt actually creates models of the routes and proactively switches when loss is projected to become unacceptable. Google has already rolled out BBR on YouTube, which is already highly optimized and has seen between 4 and 14% speed boosts. So speed is good.
Oops. Sorry, Essential just shared everyone's personal information with a reply all. So while the company was trying so hard to use a scan of customers' driver's licenses as a way to reduce fraud, it did a total noob move and did the equivalent of a reply all when the information was sent back to the company. So while this doesn't look like a phishing scheme, it does look like Essential just wasn't paying attention. And when users sent back the scan of their license, it actually sent copies of that scan to everyone on the list.
Well, that does it for the blips. Next up, we've got the bites. And Chibert, I'm sorry, but this bite is probably going to get a little ranty on my side. Just as a disclaimer, if you don't like rants, you can fast forward about 10 minutes. Now, Comcast is suing a public utility commission. Now, that's not new. In just the past few months, we've seen no fewer than a dozen lawsuits brought against PUCs across varying states over everything from pole attachment to net neutrality stipulations. Now, what makes this lawsuit different is that Comcast is suing to remove a community access provision to which it had already agreed. Now, here's what we know. In 2005, Comcast purchased Adelphia, a service provider in Vermont. Along with that purchase came the agreement to abide by state procedures, which includes a provision to build out cable networks to unserved areas to meet community needs. Now, that provision is a direct descendant of the 1984 Cable Act, which allows municipalities to give cable operators preferential treatment in regards to deployment of networks in exchange, and this is a big one, in exchange for them acting for the good of the community. Now, here's the problem. According to the Vermont Public Utility Commission, an operator's permit must be renewed every 11 years. As of January of this year, it's been 11 years. Comcast received the same permit they did last time, the same permit Adelphia had been operating under, the same permit that Comcast agreed to abide by when they bought Adelphia. But now they want that community needs and common good provision removed, and they're suing to do just that. Now, at issue is how the VPUC is interpreting the provision. They say that if Comcast wants the permit, the latter must construct no less than 550 miles of line extensions into currently uncabled areas within the 11-year term of the permit. Comcast, on their part, says that the 550-mile extension contravenes federal and state law and violates their First Amendment rights. And then they add in a bunch of boilerplate of how it also takes away choice from consumers. Now, Cheever, I'm going to hold in the rage just a little bit because I actually do want to have a fruitful conversation about this. This seems to be normal. We're seeing this a lot where you have operators who sue to remove provisions to which they've already agreed. Now, this is a little bit different than some of the others because this is a renewal of a permit, but this is a stipulation that they've already operated under. But now, perhaps sensing the changing political winds, they thought this is a time for us to strike and strip this out altogether. But let's start at the basics. Should Comcast, as the ISP of the area, have an obligation to extend their network? I mean, they're paying for it. It's their money. It's their deployment. It's their capital expenditure. Should they have to run into areas that they know they'll never make a profit on?
I'm having trouble with the First Amendment rights. Really?
Okay, we'll get to that. We'll get to the First Amendment. But I mean, let's not laugh at it yet. Let's go ahead and talk about the first part. Why? Okay, so why should a company have that obligation?
Because that's part of the contract. So, Ma Bell, you know, back in the big monopolies, actually, as part of regulations, Lifeline Services, it's when you sign a contract to cover an area. You're signing a contract for both the good and the bad, and the contract is based upon your agreement to the contract is supposed to be based upon the good and the bad averaging out so that you can still make a profit. You've agreed to both good and bad. And I'm sorry, Comcast is trying to wiggle out of the bad portion. Does that mean, I'm going to wiggle out of providing warranty service in the future just because I don't want to service, say, that laptop or that car or something? Sorry, Comcast, you're trying to only go for the good, not the bad. The contract is for the average of the whole area. You've got areas where you're going to make a ton of money. You've got areas where you're not going to make any money. They average out. That's what doing business is about. You're just trying to get trying to get your cake and eat it too, and you're not dealing with the fact that you signed that contract. I'm sorry.
Yeah, this is one of those things that I think gets lost in the discussion so often because as I set up this situation, people will ask, well, why should Comcast have to do something that's a clear money loss? I mean, I would never run my business that way. I would never agree to deliberately lose money into many, many years into the future. However, Cheebert, the point that you're bringing out is the fact that the only reason why Comcast is allowed to deploy like this in the first place is because they already agreed to what you're calling the bad. They agreed that they're providing a public good. Now, they are being allowed by the local government to make money off of this agreement. They're allowed to make profit, but in exchange, they have to watch out for the common good and the community needs. They want to get out of that second part. They want the profit. And they want the privilege of being able to deploy where they want to deploy, but without the part about dealing with the common good and community needs. I think that's where the obligation comes from. Now, let's move on to the next part. They're saying, essentially, that the VPUC, the Vermont Public Utilities Commission, does not have the right to regulate them, that the right to regulate falls under state and federal law. And they're doing that because they believe that the state and the federal levels will be far more sympathetic to their cause. Where do you fall on that? There is something to be said there about a local municipality trying to take power that it shouldn't have. And this is a strategy that has worked very well for AT&T and for Comcast and for Verizon in the past. Do you think that applies here?
Oh, man. Rant on.
Okay, rant, go.
Okay. Comcast has been abusing the Public Utilities Commissions of all 50 states plus the territories to get their cake and eat it too. They've lobbied the PUCs to go and get their way. And for the most part, the PUCs have said, okay, fine. You're providing services, you're allowed to make profit, life, you know, go ahead. Now what they're trying to do is just saying, oh, we've got a PUC that's not quite so tame anymore. And we don't like that. So we don't like what mommy says. We're going to go and ask daddy. Because they think daddy in the White House is going to take care of them because Trump is pro-business. You know, I'm sorry to bring Trump in there. But the reality is, you know, okay, Comcast, if you don't want to play this game that you agreed to and you've agreed to since the days of Ma Bell being broken apart. And, oh, by the way, Comcast now has to agree to the new rules of regulation and so forth. You've had 30 years to play this game and you don't want to play the game anymore. Okay, fine. Here's Chibert's solution. If you don't want to do the bad side, let's open this territory up in Vermont to anyone that wants to do it and is going to make the commitment to fulfill the rights of the contract. Comcast, if you don't want to play, I think Vermont should negate your contract and put it out to bid again.
Actually, that's a very good point. I'm glad you brought that up. It's not really the legality. It's the fairness option. And the fairness option is, if you don't want to abide by the thing that you agreed to so long ago because you think it's now outdated, then we are no longer bound to give you preferential treatment when you try to deploy your network, which means all of those issues about pole attachment and right of way and where I can deploy my fiber should now be open to any ISP that wants to deploy in my area. And as we all know, all of the incumbents, AT&T, Comcast, Verizon, Time Warner, they're all fighting that tooth and nail. Now, the legality part for me, it's really simple. I don't see how a judge could side with Comcast on this because they're trying to use the 1984 Cable Act to say that the states and the federal government have control over who gets a permit and who doesn't. However, in the 1984 Cable Policy Act, which all of this stems for, it specifically gives municipality governing bodies of cities and towns the principal authority to grant or renew franchise licensing. Full stop. That's actually in the Cable Act. And the reason why they put that in there was because they actually wanted to free businesses from regulations that would be handed down by the state and the federal governments. So in other words, Comcast is trying to take something that was designed to take regulations away from them and saying it's now being overly restrictive, which is ridiculous. The other part of that is in the 1984 Cable Act, it again specifically says that any authorizing authority, so any group, the PUC in this particular case, can look at the past and future performance of an entity to determine whether or not it should get a permit, and that it has the full authority to alter the policies within that permit in order to make sure that that provider is meeting the spirit of the 1984 Cable Act. Now, the whole reason why this is fuzzy is because the 1984 Cable Act was deliberately vague. They didn't want to be overly restrictive because they wanted to spark business. And they also didn't want to spell out specifically what penalties would be because they wanted it to be on a case-by-case basis. However, that first part of the 1984 Act tells us that the case-by-case basis is decided by the PUC. So, no. Definitely not. Now, let's go to this last part, Cheaper, because this is the part that you called out first. This is fun.
Yeah.
The fact that this ruling, the fact that VPUC wants them to deploy 550 miles where they currently don't have any network, violates Comcast's First Amendment right. I'm still very unclear on how it actually does that. Do you have a sense on what they're actually claiming?
I have a sense. The Comcast lawyers are going, how are we going to wiggle out of this? We're obligated to wiggle out of it, but how? Let's throw a dart at the Constitution and see if we can find something. No, I'm sorry. Comcast is grasping at straws, and the lawyers are trying to save their jobs.
Yeah. And I'll offer one last bit of semi-rant here. Again, back to the 1984 Communications Act. It specifically addressed the First Amendment, but not in the way that you think. They talked about the First Amendment rights of the customers of the ISP, the customers of the service provider. Specifically, there's a part within the 1984 Act that says, quote, the widest possible diversity of information sources and services, unquote, must be provided by the service provider. In other words, we are giving you this preferential treatment and the ability to deploy your network and exchange. You are protecting the First Amendment rights of your customers. Now, if that's not a huge slap in the face to Comcast, I don't know what is. The strange thing here, though, Chiebert, is I get the sense that Comcast probably has a sympathetic ear or two in the court. And this might actually drag out to the point where the VPUC says, fine, just let it go. What can we do as an audience to perhaps prop them up, to help them out? Because as you said, all of the providers have done this across all 50 of the states because they can tackle each one individually. At some point, the PUCs have to be able to stand up and say, no, this is the line in the sand and you can't cross it.
Yeah. And hey, I actually went and testified in my Public Utilities Commission. In my case, we were trying to deregulate the Interlata communications market, so because it was costing us more money to make a telephone call to the neighbor islands than it costs for us to call the 48 states. So the public can do things. There are political action groups. I would say, Vermont citizens, write your Public Utilities Commission, bury them under mail. Tell them that you're behind them, because the Public Utilities Commission typically they hardly ever hear from the public. They only hear from the lobbyists. So make your voice heard. Call, write, email. And to this I say, Father, amen.
I'm actually with you on that. This is one of those times to write. Anytime you hear or see in the news, PUC versus insert ISP here. Those PUCs are typically overworked and underpaid, especially considering what they're responsible for. They need to hear from us. They need to hear from members of the public that, yeah, they are doing a good job, that we are glad that at least one organization is willing to stick up for the rights of consumers. At least one organization is willing to make sure that these service providers are accountable to the agreements that they made 10, 20, 30 years ago, or actually 40 in this particular case.
Remember, it is the Public Utilities Commission, not the Comcast Utilities Commission.
Well, I think they're going to bid over naming rights. Let's go ahead and move on to something that's a little less politically contentious, but very important. Now, we all know, we've all seen the pictures, we've all seen the videos of the disaster down in Texas. We understand that there's a lot of suffering in Houston right now, and the immediate concern are the people. And right now they're starting to get back on their feet. They're starting to roll in supplies, and that's all good. However, Chiebert, we've got experience with this now. In the lifespan of Twiat, we had Hurricane Sandy. And Hurricane Sandy had a very similar effect. Major metropolitan area, huge storm, and it destroyed IT infrastructure. And that's what we want to talk about. I don't want to minimize any of the other suffering, but this is an IT show. Let's talk a little bit about IT. Now, let's face it. The fourth biggest city in the United States, that's the greater Houston area, is going to have a lot of IT infrastructure. It's the home to a heck of a lot of co-location and computing power, data exchanges, cloud centers, you name it. That's how it works. You have a large population center. You want to get the data as close to that population center as possible so that you get faster transmit times. Now, that's all good, except for the fact that, like in Sandy, we're now having a lot of those centers being marked as destroyed. Not just damaged, but completely destroyed. Chiebert, we've had experience with this. In Sandy, it was the old copper infrastructure that was wiped out. In fact, they replaced all of it, Verizon, with fiber, because it was just unsalvageable. You can't salvage something that's built off of a physical plant almost 60 years old that was underwater for a week or two. In this particular case, a lot of the infrastructure in Houston was fiber. Is that going to hold up any better, or are we looking at the same, if it's flooded, you got to pull it out and replace it?
Well, the whole thing that a lot of people keep forgetting is fiber optics inherently, while it's wrapped in armor and wrapped in plastic and all kinds of other good things. They even go as far as putting in antifungal gels and powders into the cables. But with this amount of water leaking into the cables, a lot of this antifungal compound is going to get washed away. Now, here's the problem. The fungus among us grows roots. The roots, just like a tree, is strong enough. You know, you've seen trees where they split giant boulders. The roots of mold and mildew will do the same thing to fiber optics. And the problem is, this is a very slow process.
Right.
We're going to start losing fiber optic trunks probably a month or so down the line. In addition, one of the problems we're also going to start having is, where's all this gear? You know, if we've got some data centers underwater, or we now have data centers that are that maybe the air conditioning's going down, and we've got mold and mildew growing, now all of a sudden a lot of these data centers don't run so well anymore. Keep in mind, a vast majority of the APNs for cellular carriers are in that area.
That's right. That's right. And so the problem with this is it's going to be – this is like a time-delayed bomb in that if a provider kind of wants to chance it and say, we think the plant is okay, we don't need to go through the multi-million dollars worth of replacement costs, in a month, in 2 months, in 3 months, that's when we might actually start seeing the impact. And it will be sporadic, and it will be random, and there's really no way to tell. Now, in Sandy, they had an interesting tool. They were able to take thermal cameras down into the substation vaults and actually look at banks of copper cable. Actually, these. And because it was copper, they could see where there were shorts because they'd see little thermal flares. We don't have that with fiber optics. With fiber optics, it's just sort of like, well, it works now. Who knows if it's going to be working properly in 3 months? As you said, we might start getting those little fungal roots down into our fiber core. So what's the prognosis here? Should every provider in the Houston area just rip out all the trunks and replace them?
Obviously, that's not financially possible.
Right.
But I think they're going to have to change their maintenance schedule. I think they're going to have to retire trunks a lot faster than they had planned on. And, you know, with a lot of these streets and areas flooded, you're going to have a lot of conduits that are collapsing. You're going to have a lot of conduits that are filled with mud. Now, all of a sudden, repairing them is going to be really, really difficult. That I heard this morning a pundit, you know, saying Harvey's going to cost us $190 billion.
Wow.
I think that's low.
I think so too.
I think we're going to see, my best guess is probably closer to $220, $250 billion, because I don't think the mainstream media is realizing just how expensive it is to replace all that conduit-based optics.
Yeah, just the traditional transit infrastructure, so roads and exchanges, that's going to run up to $15 to $20 billion. If you start considering how much IT runs through Houston and trying to determine how much of that you have to replace versus how much you can salvage, that's easily $20 to $40 billion right there.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, in IT, one of the worst things that you can do is to put in a level of uncertainty. I mean, I can deal with failure as long as I know when it's going to fail. I can't trust a link that might fail. And if I'm going to have that in my network, it's definitely going to have to be a backup link. It's going to have to be.
Yeah.
I could actually see a lot of IT business shifting away from Houston for a while, just in case that infrastructure isn't really ready to go back online.
Well, you and I both have a lot of friends in the long haul carrier world. The long haul carriers are shifting around Houston just in case.
Yep. Yeah. You're seeing a lot of APNs make alternative arrangements just in case.
My APN, I'm just really happy. My primary APN is Walnut Creek, California. My secondary is Houston.
Ooh, okay. Well, that is going to be a developing story. We'll come back in a couple of weeks, a couple of months, because I think only then will we actually start to realize. There'll be little stories popping up here and then about some links not being trustworthy. And if more of those than others say Houston, then the story has legs. Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. Next up, we've got my favorite time of the show. It's when we bring a guest into the Twiat studios and have him drop knowledge on the Twiat riot. We welcome to the show the CEO of ShotPut, Praful Mathur. Thank you very much for coming on to This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, ShotPut is it's an interesting business that looks to increase efficiencies in how people get their food, which is a very, very sort of dumbed down way of explaining what you do. Let's start at the basics. What gave you the idea to create ShotPut?
So we started off with enterprise logistics and supply chain management. So we've done work for companies like Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal to help them set up their e-commerce channel and their e-commerce store. We worked with Red Bull to set up direct-to-consumer deliveries, and we've worked with smaller companies that are starting off Kickstarters and other types of initiatives in the hardware world. And so we started getting really good at e-commerce logistics and e-commerce supply chain. Then our thought process was, how do we turn this into something that can be competitive with even the best guys like Walmart and Amazon? And Amazon is the 800 more than that, yeah, like
a 50,000 ton gorilla in the room, I think.
Right. And any movement they make kind of affects industries, not just individual companies. And so we thought about, how do we provide this kind of, we've always called ourselves the AWS for logistics, or in more technical terms, like a physical CDN, right? The ability for you to have product as close to consumer demand as you can. And we saw we needed to go to higher turn product. And that's why we started looking at refrigerated foods and that kind of stuff. Because if you get high turn, then you can add new products and then realize that you can still get it to the consumers fast enough.
Logistics has always fascinated me because it's been something that's been in the background of every success story. Anytime you go through the history of American business, or even business across the world, the business that does logistics better will normally win because they can get better efficiencies, because they can satisfy their customers more quickly, and you know, they just provide a better experience. However, in the past, logistics has sort of been that thing that's been hidden. It's an inside baseball type of thing. With Amazon being so big, it's come to the forefront. You know, Amazon, you could argue that Amazon really is a logistics company that just happens to have a semi-retail front. What have you seen change in the world of logistics as we become more and more ensconced in the e-commerce world? So from the traditional world to the e-commerce world, what has changed about how we deal with logistics?
So Amazon had to make logistics a forefront issue. The main reason for that is when things are taking 7-10 days to get to your house, you have to get an awareness of what's going on. So they first told us that, you know, it's USPS or UPS or FedEx, and that gave us exposure that, oh, these people are carrying our stuff and we were used to them. Then what happened was they renamed warehouses fulfillment centers, and that gave us a sense of they're fulfilling our wishes in that building. And every iteration has been them communicating more and more to us as consumers. So consumers, we got really used to it. Then the evolution of why logistics became a powerhouse for venture capital was because of Uber and Lyft. They basically said, if you can move people and you can move things around the world, you can build an empire. And really, logistics innovation has occurred since the beginning of time, right? You win wars because of logistics. Walmart won the industry because of logistics. Before that, you had other companies that won logistics based on the shipping container. And so entire worlds and nations have shifted their GDPs based on how well their economy can function in the logistics world. And so we looked at it and said, well, logistics has always, as you said, been the critical driver of success for not just companies, but nations. How do we get involved in this world so that we can eventually help people at a emerging company have the same base of logistics as Walmart and Amazon can?
All right. Let's break it down even further, because you're not just logistics. You're a specific type of logistics. You Correct. Are perishable logistics, which adds all sorts of complexity. You're not just moving things from place to place. You have to think about expiration. You have to think about storage. You have to think about accessibility to the people who actually need just-in-time supplies. Again, food. Can you explain to me, if you were doing an elevator pitch to a VC for ShotPut, how would you explain it? What would be your 30-second pitch as to this is what we do and this is why we're unique.
Okay, so I'll just caveat this, is that the perishable stuff is actually a partnership with other grocery stores and stuff like that. So the pitch mostly to VCs, and this is good because we're raising, is that we've built a platform for a micro-fulfillment center. So to break that down further, essentially today when you get a warehouse, you have to talk to people. You have to make sure that you're, the way that you want to do the logistics is figured out correctly. You're able to understand how to get the goods to where you need to be. So there's a lot of thinking in terms of how do you move your product to the consumer. What we're saying is we will move your product to your consumer as quickly as we possibly can. And we started off with perishable goods with this particular model because we need high turn goods. And we can partner with grocery stores who are already selling the stuff, turn them into 24-hour stores and compete with Amazon Go and Amazon Instant Pickup, because Amazon's not going to win everything, right?
Well, we hope. I mean, and I love Amazon. I use them all the time. But you're right. I like to have variety in the market. I like there to be competition. Everyone benefits from competition. But let me ask you, what's going to be your secret sauce? Because you talk about high turn. You talk about being able to deliver from, say, the supermarket to like a train station. I mean, that's one of the pitches that's on the ShotPut website. How do you do that without making it a cost, a lost leader?
So the biggest costs in logistics are time and distance. And the closer you are to the consumer, the lower the time and the lower the cost. And then when you start looking at last mile carriers, the reason why you have weight limitations and weight-based pricing is that you're moving things through the United States, which is a very large country. When you go through different warehouses and sorting centers with FedEx and UPS, they want to minimize the amount of work that each of their employees does. When you're talking about going from a local manufacturer to a local location nearby, to then using an Uber or Axle Drive or one of these last mile carriers, and you can bring it to the consumer on a scheduled basis, your costs are inherently going to go down because you're closer, right? Now, historically, e-commerce has been from the center of the country out to the urban areas. With Amazon Amazon Prime now and Amazon anything, they're showing that you need to be at the urban destinations. You can't just be 2 days.
ShotPut has been a quiet success, a rising star. In fact, I've seen some numbers that says that your perishable items delivery has been rising 30% week over week, which, of course, that's not completely sustainable. At some point, it's going to peter off. But what do you attribute that to? Because you've been doing what I would consider the super high-risk items, poke offerings, salads, all of the super high perishable items. What is it that you do? I mean, aside from getting distribution centers closer and closer to the customers, that allows you to take those high risks with the high perishable items and not get burned?
A lot of our goods are on consignment basis.
Okay, that's good. That's a super secret. Yeah.
And the other thing is that, that's like a pretty well-known thing in the grocery model, is that you do consignment. But we're working with smaller brands. And the main reason to work with smaller brands is that we can help them expand. Secondly, we can work with them to improve volumes. And then the last thing is, if they're able to expand out their market, they're going to provide us pricing that is beneficial to them and to us. Whereas if we worked with a Coca-Cola or even a Red Bull, we're not going to get that kind of pricing.
I don't want you to expose any of your proprietary secrets, so please don't do any of that. However, people are going to say, all right, well, partnerships. Obviously, partnerships are very important, and ShotPut's been very good with that. You've been working with things like Uber Eats, Postmate, and Caviar. Which is good, because you don't want to have to go it all alone if there's already established players in the market. However, I have to believe that you do have some wonderful IT in the background that is helping you to make sure that items arrive when they're supposed to arrive, that logistics are spread out properly, and that attentions to details are being paid. Can you tell me a little bit about that? Anything you can tell me about what runs the back end of ShotPut?
Sure. And the main thing here, and actually the biggest thing with logistics, is there are actually no silver bullet solutions, and there's no like proprietary secret that's going to blow away everything. It's really just a consistent effort continually applied to your operations that makes you really good. And you'll see this with Amazon. Nothing Amazon does is a secret. It's just that they do it at such scale. And the main thing that we have is an inventory system that tells us where things are, when are they expected to get to us, how quickly are they supposed to get to us, how quickly are they supposed to leave the store. Everything is first in, first out. But even then, there's complexity in terms of what happens when there is something that is expiring, right? You have to deal with it.
And let's talk about, I love this animation. This is part of the first in, first out part of logistics, which it seems really simple. But I remember speaking to a, I can't remember what his rank was, but he was a military officer whose job it was to load. He was a load master. And one of the most important parts of his job is to make sure that he never has items that need to be delivered first that are all the way to the front of the plane. I would consider that to be the same piece of secret for ShotPut, where you need to make sure your trucks run as efficiently as possible. So your load in and load out are just as important as what you actually carry. What do you use for that? Is that something that you've built? Is that something that you've taken off the shelf? Is it something that you're running on-premise in the cloud?
Everything we do is run on the cloud, but we've built everything ourselves. The main reason for that is with inventory, every inventory system does things slightly different, but we need to be able to manage a lot of different things with our carriers. We need our vendors.
Right.
We need to be able to tell them as we evolve, we're going to have to change packaging. Right now, we have to repackage everything ourselves. We have to tell what state things are, where they're coming from, when something is ready to deploy. The trucks are still being built out. Right now, we do a lot of stuff manually. It's a lot more expensive. The point of the trucks is to start to distribute this out further and further to our carrier's destination so that our costs come down and we can deploy these things much faster. Everything's refrigerated. Like what we're trying to do is become the most efficient way to move goods around the top 40 cities to start.
And what's the end game here? What would you like to see once you get your fleet of trucks built and everything's automated and the logistics system back end is working perfectly so that everything is loaded properly into a truck? Is it having drop-off points where trucks just go from spot to spot to spot and automatically drop off the intended load for that particular destination? Where do you see ShotPut being in, say, 2 years?
In 2 years, where we want to be is in the top 40 cities. We want to be the physical CDN, and we want to have fully automated supply chains. Now, how far we can get with automated trucks and automated movement of goods and all of that stuff, 2 years is probably not the right time horizon, but say 10, 15 years. And in the supply chain, there's also a production ability. And in 10, 15 years, you'll see ability for 3D printers to be much better about the way that we print electronics, the way that we understand and we build things are going to become much more mass customized rather than, I mean, made to order will become a bigger thing. And you're seeing that with Amazon's patent on making clothes that are delivered to you, an AI bot that can tell what the fashion trends should be. I think some of that is interesting experiments. We'll see how they actually perform in the market. But what you're seeing is that production is going to happen closer to consumption. And it'll be interesting to see how this leaves countries like China, right? But you're starting to see a lot more in China and India and the U.S. is made in this country. And so we'll see a lot more of that as this moves forward.
I love that optimism. I remember there was a keynote by Jeff Bezos a while back in which he said something along the lines, I'm paraphrasing, the best business plans are 80% what I can build now and 20% what I think I might be able to build in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the fact that you've got that. That's part of your DNA, which is, yeah, we can build this stuff now, but we are assuming that we will be able to increase efficiencies even further, and we're actually building that into the plan, the 10-year plan. So kudos to you. Now, I want to bring Cheebert back in, but before we get to him, I got to bring up the big question. Emily the Strange and others are asking it in our chat room right now, which is, we talked about it, the multi-ton elephant in the room. Amazon does this incredibly well, and Amazon is now doing this with Whole Foods. How does ShotPut, which is a startup, compete against a company that's already established, already has the infrastructure, and, you know, I'm sorry, but has way more money to burn than you will?
Well, it comes back to is we're probably not going to beat Amazon anytime soon.
Right.
But if we're 0.25% of their market value, that's a $1 billion company. And so will Amazon leave these threats idly? No. But will other brands who are looking to aggressively pursue the path that Amazon has blazed be interested, like a Walmart? Correct, right? They've spent $3.3 billion on Jet when they're losing billions of dollars a year. Target, Sears, all of these companies, well, Sears is partnered with Amazon, but you see that all of these companies are very frightened, right? And if you look at India, which is the next biggest market that is going to emerge in e-commerce, Amazon's also crushing the game there too.
Right.
So is there a vested interest to see a competitor to Amazon globally? Yeah. And that's what we're banking ourselves on. Will we become as big as Amazon as quickly as they've become it? I can't speak to that. Only time can tell. But what I can tell you is that something like this will exist. Amazon is working on it, and other people should be mindful that they should be working on it too.
People should remember that for the first decade of its existence, Amazon was a joke.
Right.
Amazon was the stock punching bag. It was, oh my goodness, this business is never going to succeed. Its business model is way, way too messy. And I like your approach. You're acknowledging, yeah, we're not going to take 100% of the business away from Amazon. We don't have to. 2.5% is $1 billion. I think that's pretty damn good.
0.25%.
Oh, sorry, 0.25%. Wow.
$400 billion.
0.25%? Yeah, that's doable. That's definitely doable. Let's go ahead and bring back into the show my co-host, Brian. Cheebert, I could see where something like ShotPut would be wonderful in a big city like San Francisco, New York. I mean, it's absolutely what people are looking for. It reduces the local supply chain from a bus ride or a car ride down to a walk to the corner. You have a slightly different market where you live. Do you think ShotPut would be competitive in a smaller but still very advanced city like Honolulu?
Actually, I think ShotPut would be a beautiful fit because there's already a corporation here in Honolulu that is doing something very, very similar, but old school. Lots of humans involved, lots of warehouses. There's a corporation called ABC Stores. If you're in Waikiki, you can't swing a cat without hitting an ABC store. Now, square footage-wise, they have just as much square foot as, say, like a Vons or a Safeway or something like that. The difference is they have really high-turn items. They're easily packaged. They're easy to ship. And because they're in super, super, super high-cost areas like Waikiki where the square footage is insanely expensive, they don't have stock rooms. Stock rooms cost money and they don't produce money. So having ABC Stores has been doing this manually for just in time delivery. I could easily see things like electric trucks with the ShotPut arm in there dropping off things like right as the store starts running out, doing some predictive algorithms. I think this is actually going to be even better for smaller cities because in smaller cities, you're going to start seeing a lot more people wanting that mom and pop store, but they can't compete with the giant supermarkets. I think technology like this is going to bring back the corner store because the corner stores don't have to take the giant risk on stock rooms and they can leverage, say, ShotPut technology to help them on predictive algorithms on what they should be stocking or what they should be on the shelves.
I love that. What about that? I mean, a smaller store can be a bigger store if they have a technology like ShotPut behind them and a logistics force like ShotPut behind them so that they do get things just in time. Is that part of the business model or are you really focused on sort of large urban areas?
That is precisely the business model.
Okay, there you go.
We're working with local stores in Oakland, for instance. And the reason, again, right, we're a small company. We can only work with small brands and small vendors. We have conversations with Walmart and Target and UPS and USPS. But all these guys look at it and say, why is this going to help us beat Amazon? And I tell them every time, which is an answer they don't want to hear, is, you're not going to beat Amazon with a silver bullet. We're only going to do it with a maniacal focus over a long period of time where you're communicating to customers at a consistent enough basis why you are a better place to shop. And Walmart is used to it, right? But they've lost that touch in the digital world, and they're looking for a way to say, I want to just jump to the success of Amazon. You're already there. 90% of the U.S. population is 10 to 15 miles away from you. Use that advantage and do it fast. The only way, and there's a good book, it was actually suggested to Tim Cook's employees, and he writes about it. It's called Competing Against Time. And the thesis in that book is the faster you're able to serve customers, the more successful you will be. And they talk about why Walmart at the time in the early 90s was smaller than Kmart, but over the course of a decade they would become the dominant brand, and Kmart would have have trouble. At the end of the decade, Kmart went bankrupt. Walmart became the largest retailer in the world. So you have to just apply that reasoning, which is, how do I meet customer demand faster, and how do I get them things that they want before they even know they want it?
And actually the Walmart versus Kmart story, if anyone has not read up on it, it is a fascinating bit of logistical competition. It's what happens when the old model of just get bigger is always the best way to grow versus more efficient. And ShotPut definitely falls into the more efficient category. It's, we don't need to have a huge stock to be a huge store. We just have to make sure that you have the things that you want when you want them. All right. So we are running out of time. So I'm going to give you plenty of time to plug at the end. But from the CEO chair, what do you think are the two or three pieces that you absolutely need to come up with, you need to assemble in order to grow ShotPut over the next year? What are your immediate concerns? What are your immediate worries? What are the technologies that you need to be most concerned about?
Are these technologies that are competitive threats to us, or are things that we need to use to build the solution?
Yes, both of those.
So from a competitive threat perspective, what's really the most threatening here is Amazon's ability to move into places faster and then offer this as a platform, right? They've done this with almost everything. They've done this with warehouses with FBA. They've done this with computation with AWS. They've done this with their own retail store with Marketplace and Seller. And they'll continue to do this for a very long time. So that's a competitive threat. In terms of what we need to build this, I mean, robotic arms are still very brittle, very inflexible. And so our entire business in our technology right now is... So this is the part we can't talk too much about, but what we can say is we spent a lot of time making sure that our ability to actuate the arms and our way to do the computer vision is very controlled. And the environment that we've created, we spent more time working on the environment than on the algorithms. That's what I can tell you.
I love it. Thank you so very much. We have been speaking with the CEO of ShotPut, Praful Mathur. Am I saying that properly? Praful.
Yes, that
Praful
is correct.
Mathur.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not great with names. And this has been absolutely fascinating. Anytime someone can take an enterprise lesson and apply it to something that we could really be seeing on our streets within months, I'm always very excited. Now, could you please tell our audience, look straight into your camera, tell our audience where they can find you, where they can find ShotPut, where they can get more information about your business model, and maybe for those people who are really interested, how they could potentially join this revolution of just-in-time logistics.
For sure. So we're at shotput.com. My email's on the tag, which is praful@shotput.com. Anyone who's interested, please email me. Shotput.com will actually be updated shortly after this show goes live to now talk about the new direction of where we're taking the company. And you'll see a lot more stuff about the robotics and where we're going with it. But we still have an existing operation running logistics and fulfillment for people. So, but definitely email me, and I'll be happy to answer any questions or talk to you about your concerns.
That's awesome. Now, I will make you this promise. When you get your robotic technology to the point where you want it, where you want to demo it, I will bring a crew with me. We will go to your office and we will actually show it in action, because I know our audience across the network, across our shows, would love to see that. Can I make you that challenge?
Absolutely. And also, when we do launch it, there's going to be something interesting for your viewers to also be able to interact with it live. Uh-oh. So
you shouldn't tell that to our audience. That's quite right. They can be a little trolly. They love stuff like that.
Well, What I can say is that we want to make this interactive because as the future unfolds, we think that not only will small businesses thrive, but so will developers who can make this thing more valuable. And so the same way Amazon made Alexa a skill set that was open, we want to make our container bot something that's open for people to program.
Rafael, thank you again. And great job. And we will have you back.
Thank you.
And folks, I'm afraid you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 robotic delivery trucks. I want to thank everyone who has made this show possible. Of course, that means Chibert. Brian, you are the producer of the show. You found ShotPut, and this is incredible. I love hearing about technology that has not existed before. Could you please tell the Twite Right where they can find you if you're not melting, and what you'll be up to over the next week?
I'm on Twitter at ADVNETLAB, or I am Chibert at twit.tv. And oh, by the way, you found ShotPut and told me to pursue it. So kudos to you, dude.
See, I can't even remember anymore. This
ShotPut in Tokyo would be amazing.
I know we've got it in the chat room saying, oh, yeah, Tokyo. Yeah, any place where it's really hard to move around and super dense, I could see that. Actually, that's kind of a ghost in the shell type thing. But, oh, okay, back to you, Chibert. Where can they find you and what are you doing?
I'm melting. I'm building servers. And I am filling out tons and tons of paperwork because I am looking at being able to retire from the university soon and maybe do more TV,
ooh,
do more articles, and maybe start writing that fiction series I've been threatening for years.
I love this. This is all good stuff, especially since it's a little bit cryptic because you never know what Chibert's got cooking up. Also, thanks to you, to the person who watches and listens each and every single week. Without our audience, without our Twite Right, we don't have a show. It's you who have kept us on the air all these years, and we want to make it easier for you to get your fill of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Just go to our show page at twit.tv/Twiet. That's T-W-I-E-T. There you'll find all of our episodes, our back episodes, as well as links to all the stories that we've talked about during our episodes. If you want to find out more, that's a great place to go. But also, if you want to support the show, you have to subscribe. We've got an audio version, a video version, and a high-definition video version. You can have it delivered automatically into your device of choice each and every single week. Share it with a friend. Tell your friends about Twiet. Tell them they need to become part of the riot. Again, that's twit.tv/Twiet. Also, don't forget that you can find me on Twitter. That's right. Just go to twitter.com/PadreSJ. There you will find what I do when I'm not in the studio. Like, look at this. This is Ford's newest self-driving technology. It's not as advanced as Tesla's, but my goodness, it is so fluffy. Again, twitter.com/PadreSJ, especially if you want to suggest guests for future episodes of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Finally, thanks to everyone here who makes this show possible, to Lisa and Leo, who have allowed us to stay on the air all these years, to the engineering crew, John, who helped to push all of our buttons and get everything connected, and of course, to my TD, Kevin the Shark. Kevin, this is the time of the show where we offer you a chance at redemption by asking you a question about some information that came up during the show. And I think what I have to ask now is, if ShotPut is building a fully robotic truck, where will the ghost be stored?
Crossing the streams.
Oh, I'm sorry. The correct answer was in a Honko cyber brain, but maybe we'll get you again next week. Until then, I am Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiet.